Chris Simpson from the Stage Left Podcast. Welcome to episode 61 with Ed Blaney, former manager of The Fall and right-hand man and compadre to Marquis Smith. What a chat we had, actually. He travelled down from Manchester for a few days down to London, and we met up. We ate some food, cracked open a few tins of beer, which you may hear on the recordings, by the way, and recorded a belt of an episode. Special thank you to David Lloyd, also known as Bumble, former England cricket coach and voice to many of the game, an expert ale pub recommender, as I was lucky enough to bump into Bumble in a bar in St. Lucia a couple of months ago, and he insisted I got on Ed, going through his phone there and then to give me Ed's number, and he was the reason this episode went ahead. So we hope you enjoy this one, Bumble. As regular listeners know, we do live supper clubs in our lounge in London, where we get guests of the podcast to do an intimate live acoustic set to just you and seven other fans, whilst my partner Davila, who's an award-winning chef, cooks a five-course meal for us all. And we sit down with a guest and eat great food, drink lots, and listen to vinyl records before the guest plays a few tunes to us. Previous attendees have been Radiohead live drummer Clive Deamer, John Woff of the 1975, She Drew the Gun, and we've got James Walsh from Star Sailor on June the 8th too. So get in touch on social media or email stageleftnights@gmail.com if you want to come. Word is that Ed is going to do one of these nights too coming up. We're also going to veer off course a little bit on the 29th and 30th of May, as the Cricket World Cup is taking place 2 minutes from our flat near the Oval. So we're going to kind of do the same type of night, but instead of musicians, it's going to be an ex-player or broadcaster as guest. And so when the day's play is over, we can kind of carry on the party and enjoy great food. And this is kind of a test or a trial, if you like, with the aim to do it each night of the Ashes in September. So acclaimed writer George DeBell is going to do the first one on May the 30th. So Bumble, if you want to get over and pop over to us after the day's play, we owe you an ale for sorting this episode, so that would be great. For listeners globally who don't know what cricket is, just ignore the last 90 seconds of your life, but you can settle down now to enjoy Ed Blaney on his time as manager of The Fall and co-writer with Marquis Smith. Special thanks to David Walford, Alex Soykins and Andy Phelan for their behind the scenes work as ever. So sit down, enjoy, relax, crack open a beer like we did, and enjoy Ed Blaney. Okay, welcome to the Stage Left Podcast, lifting the veil on the music industry by telling the stories of those with a unique vantage point. The podcast exists to provide free educational content for young musicians entering an increasingly complex industry by telling the stories of some of the unsung heroes behind the success. Go to stageleftpodcast.com for all episodes featuring musicians who discuss in detail the recording, writing and performing processes with the likes of Guns N' Roses, Elvis Presley, Kraftwerk, The Beatles, David Bowie, Beyonce, Fleetwood Mac, Nick Cave, Oasis, The 1975, Bob Dylan and The Stone Roses. Today we are joined by Ed Blaney, a critically acclaimed songsmith who is most well known for his collaborations with the genius and enigmatic Marquis Smith. First, he's manager of The Fall as well as bandmate and co-writer. Ed became close friends with Mark, and Mark indeed went on to guest on Ed's solo records before Mark's untimely passing last year. Today we'll be taking a deep dive into that collaboration, as well as finding out how someone goes about managing a band like The Fall. We'll be discussing Ed's new album, which is currently being recorded in Berlin, the joys and headaches of coordinating your own festival, and we'll be finding out if it's true that Ed chose to drop his first name from promoting gigs as gig-goers kept asking why he wasn't playing David Bowie songs at his shows, only to find out that someone else with the same name had won Stars in Their Eyes as David Bowie the year before. So it's a pleasure to say that our guest today on the Stage Left Podcast is none other than the Salford legend, Ed Blaney. Thanks for joining us today, Ed.
How's Hello. It going, mate? Good, very good.
Good. So you're recording at the moment in Berlin, or you have been recording in Berlin. How's that been going?
Yeah, brilliant. So we've been out three times already this year, and it's the same place we did The Severance in, 1950s cinema. Brilliant space, a great place in Wedding, and it was a no-brainer, really. It was like you know, we was going to do it in Russia, and then Australia came up, and we thought, you know what, it's a bit far. There's always a bit, so it's like, yeah, let's get back to Berlin, and it's going great, but what we're doing this time, it's just me and the drummer, Rick Gibbs, doing the songs along with Tito, the producer-engineer, and we're doing it blind, as in we're not taking any ideas at all. The idea writing process only begins when we get there and get off the plane. That's when the clock starts ticking.
Is that a bit scary? Not, you know, you're exposing yourself, I guess, a little bit.
It is, you know, considering I've got hundreds of songs and that I've not recorded and done, and it'd be dead easy. But it's kind of boring as well, like, to just pull out songs and you look at them and you think, nah, But it is, yeah, because you do, if it wasn't challenging, or if you didn't get nervous, it wouldn't be right. So it's good to have that, even though it's a bit backward, I must admit. But it's working. That's the main thing. We're three songs in. Rather than having like 11 ideas and then you might end up with two,
yeah,
we've actually got three pretty much finished tracks, so it's great.
Nice.
Back out in May.
And what are you writing about?
So the rules on this one are not about love, no lovey stuff or anything like that. Not that, you know, and the last stuff is good, catchy and all poppy and stuff, but yeah, it's more about life without being boring.
Mm.
And a bit more anarchy, a bit more the real me, a bit more angst. Deepness, but good deepness, you know.
Nice. What are you trying to, like, what would success look like from, like, the finished product? Not in regards to release or anything like that, but when you imagine listening back to this when it's completed, what would you have wanted to achieve?
I don't know, really. It's a good question, that. I mean, you're always striving to... You just want to be known, appreciated as an artist, and on the radio, really, you know, and on a few films and a few adverts, you know. It's bent, the system, as it is now. It's nothing to do with how good your record is now. It's how much your machine's been oiled and how much money's gone into the PR, and, you know, like the BBC used to be, you know, really good. If you were on the BBC, it was a massive thing. Now, it's a commercial thing. It's more commercial than, say, ITV in a lot of
really?
Ways. I think so, yeah.
In what way?
Well, you got like the DJs who pretty much think they're bigger than the artists themselves, and the profilers are, and the probably fees the commanding are.
Mm.
And, you know, they need to be took out to lunch, and they have their own agents and stuff, and PR stuff going on. Whereas years ago, you know, it was sacred, you know, if you worked for the BBC, you know, you were respected highly as, you know, that, and, you know, like freedom and that, but you weren't allowed to cash in as such. Kind of way in, you know, like with the fall, Peel sessions, you know, that you did them because, you know, you agreed to do them because it was exclusive for the Peel show. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, when this turned around and BBC became a bit more commercial, then all of a sudden you can buy them now in shops, which was defeating the object. It's not why you did the session in the first place.
So what are you going to do when it comes to this release? Are you going to be taking everyone out for lunch? And
no, definitely not. I mean,
absolutely. You know, like I'm shocked. I've never heard that. That's
yeah,
really shocked,
yeah, the last album, The Severance, funny enough, has had more radio than that than Urban Nature before, which had Mark on it, and we did pay a plugger, 5 ton, cheap.
Really? Yeah.
You know, but it was the plugging that I did that actually got more radio. Janice Long loved it. Me going direct. But yeah, The Severance, I got run over the week before it came out, which was a nightmare. Got hit by a car, and obviously because I manage it and do all the, we didn't do any press at all, but it ended up getting more radio than the one that we did pay. So that really made me think that yeah, I'm on the right track.
Wow. That's in regard, you just mentioned to Urban Nature there. There's I wonder if what you're doing around the production at the moment in Berlin, but there was one conversation I was having the other night with someone who is he's produced records for some amazing people, and I was saying I was listening to a song of yours called The Coat.
Yeah.
And I was, and this guy, he's been like, he's an Oscar nominated songwriter, and he's done amazing stuff. And I said, I heard something today that I'd never heard anywhere before, which is, I listened to The Coat, and my understanding was that was a background recording, something that had been left on. And is it right that Mark E. Smith couldn't find his coat? Was that right? And then did you put some music over the top of it? Is that?
No,
right?
No.
Oh, okay.
No,
my
no,
interpretation is very
no, that's there. Good. I don't know that I want to put the fire out. I mean, it's, so it was about, the story was, a landlady where I used to stay.
Right.
And a few years ago, Mark used to come round and we used to, you know, put through our partying. And, you know, she used to always hide my coat, you know, and he thought we had something going on, so it's a bit, he's winding me up, but it was actually a live recording.
Of you having a conversation, did it intend to be a song? Was it supposed to be a song?
Yeah, yeah.
It was, okay, great.
We did it, yeah. We said, right, let's, no big thought process, but we said, right, let's go, and then we did it. We had a couple of notes, and kind of like a Radio 4 thing.
That's
kind of how we did it.
So you ad-libbed a lot of it?
Yeah, completely. And there's a bit where I mean, thank God I got to edit it, you know, because he's definitely pressed my buttons. But you didn't hear that in the final thing. But that kind of just free-fall production is you know, what I love doing. You can over-rehearse things and, you know, generally the first take's the best.
Right, okay, because I think I saw you say that you did a lot of takes with Mark, and he would just do stuff in one take and that would be it, and he'd be done, that's what he wanted to do.
Yeah, they are, you know, because you can go on and on and on, and as I've got older, I've got better at that. I've not been so picky.
Yeah.
You know, I'm the worst critic of myself, so it's great to have someone in the room that says, that's good, that's fine, leave it, because you just go on forever, and then you end up losing the magic. And that's what's good about that track. It's got that live magic, you know, genuineness in there.
Awesome. And there's another track I really liked on that. There's a couple of really great tracks on that album that I picked out. One was Thinking of You. That was with Marky Smith as well.
Yeah.
The organ sounds amazing on that. Is that you playing that, or is that?
It is, yeah.
It sounds gorgeous in the chorus.
With that one, we recorded half of it in a shop that I had upstairs.
Right.
Got Mark round. Put the drums down, and then in January I won a cottage on eBay for £62, and it was amazing cottage in Holmforth where they filmed Last of the Summer Wine. Right. It's always got to be a story of me, so I was like, right, so I phoned the band, text everyone, I said, right, there's no lifts, here's the address, I've got a cottage for the week, and whoever comes, and so whoever came made it on that record, and we did the second half of it in there, the almond and stuff.
Sounds lovely.
And it was great, you know, it was great, really good. It was on the top of an hill, like dead steep, so that was a bit crap. We had to go to the shop for the milk and stuff, and cigarettes and the beer. That was the only downside, but we actually won it again. I won it again about 3 weeks later and went back and did a lot more production than that on that album there, yeah.
Do you win anything to get out to Berlin? No, that was...
Do what?
You didn't win anything to be able to get out to Berlin? Or
no, no, just that was a stroke of genius. Look how we found that studio, you know. Again, it's just blind.
And but it's an old cinema.
Yeah, it's worth taking risks, you know. If you take a risk and you're out of your comfort zone, then you're on to a winner straight away. You know, if you're doing it at home or... Like, I don't rate any studio at all in Manchester, you know. Even if it was free, I wouldn't take any of them up. You know, they're all rubbish, pretty much.
Why is that, do you think?
Just living in the past, you know. All living in... Sweet 16 was probably great, you know, in the 80s and early 90s. And, you know, and then in the 70s, you know, you had everyone who was everyone had done stuff there. And that was actually in Rochdale.
Mm.
You know, but it's just that, you know, you go in and it's like, right, we start at 10 and it's some posh get, you know, looking at his watch and you can't smoke or you can't, you know, and you have to be quiet. And I can't work in them, you know, and if you get to 5 to 10 and your session's finishing at 10, you know, you want to carry on. You know, you can't be told, oh, no, that's it. You know, you might just be. So I've always tried to avoid that scenario, and they all come with that, you know. Or the engineer will be like, oh, hang on, I just got to text my bird, or, and you know, you can't have that when you're recording.
Yeah.
Or they'll be stoned, you know, you can't have an engineer who's stoned or hungover from the night before, you know, you've got to be really professional.
You're from Salford, and we've listeners all over the globe, and there may be some people who have not heard of Salford or been to Salford. So describe Salford to listeners who've not been.
It's the ultimate shithole of poverty, where it's a great, you know, you're proud to come from that. And you're hard. The minute you're born, you know, that hardness is instilled into you and the community and stuff, you know. And I say, like, shit often, because that's how other people would say it, but, you know, if you're born in Salford and you're from Salford, you know, it's like a unique thing, and it's bizarre for people who don't know that because it's right next door to Manchester.
Mm-hmm.
But we are completely different. And I always say there's a story. So there's a River Irwell that surrounds our city and runs through Manchester. And story has it, you know, when the Romans arrived, don't know what year it was, I won't go in history, but they took one look. They were camped in Manchester. And they took one look over the river and they said, you know what, we'll stay here for the night. And that became Camp Street, you know, that's actually true. So they never crossed the river because they thought, no, we're not going to go into there. And it's just a great place. I've never been able to leave it. And, you know, he's just proud of it. You know, Peter Hook said something the other week, you know, it's probably the best thing he's ever said, a quote. And it just is, it's just got that thing, Salford, where, you know, you're in Salford and we're very different, you know. A lot of the great music that gets tagged Manchester and the great things, you know, they're all Salford.
It's actually Salford, right.
Coronation Street, you know, Salford.
Really?
Right, yeah, okay. You know.
And you say it differs. How would you describe that difference?
Well, you know, I noticed the other day when I was in a shop near my bar, the girls serving me had just a slight different accent than the girls from Salford.
Mm-hmm.
And it's bizarre, but there's just a different mentality, I think. You're always...
Because of the poverty that...
Well, yeah, I mean, it, you know, Dirty Old Town, for instance, you know, the song, it's all in that, you know. And at the moment, it's booming Salford, you know. You wouldn't think it's poverty everywhere, but... Underneath that, it's Salford has just got a real spirit about it, and it's that you know, that fight. You'd always get up and you feel hard done by, and you've got to fight for what you want. You know, if you're in a band, for instance, when I first started, first band was Trigger Happer. As soon as they hear you from Salford, you know, they don't want to put you on, so you're forever.
Really?
Your back's up all the time, yeah. You know, and it's like, we don't want Salford in here. You know, and it's nothing. Of my generation, it's from generations before, or like, you know, the old club nights, the old Salford are coming down, and the alarm bells will be ringing, so that's just with you, whether you're posh or you're not, you know, whatever class background you're from. That's, if you're from Salford, you know, that the people's eyebrows generally raise.
Interesting. So I'm from, the reason I laughed when you said shithole was I'm from Romford, and that is when people ask me what Romford's like, my go-to word is shithole, basically.
But it's a glorious, crazy. You know, glorious shithole.
Yeah, you've got to be proud from where you're from, right?
Oh, completely, yeah.
You might know Stuart Lee. He's been a big fan of the Fall Row for years and years. He came on the podcast a while ago, and he said that... my life would be very different without the Fall. And it got me thinking that it's probably, in all of us, there's a band or an artist who, if that band or artist didn't exist, you'd be quite possibly quite a different person. Who would that band or artist be for you?
100%. Well, split between, probably Dylan, though, on that sense. You know, I was a massive Neil Diamond fan as a kid.
Mm-hmm.
Great songwriter. My dad loved him, and, you know, the Irish in Salford. You know, everyone was into Neil Diamond, you know, come home from the pubs and open the windows and you'd be blasting music out. But, no, so I was quite off the rails when I was like 14, 15, 16, with drugs, you know, young and nerds. And I just heard a record of Dylan's and...
Which one?
It's off Desire, Old Sister.
Mm-hmm.
Nice, you know, your mama sees the future like your brother and yourself. You never learn to read or write, no books on your shelf.
Mm.
You know, your daddy is an outlaw. It just hit me right in the face. And I stayed in my sister's bedroom for 3 days and with some hash and withdrew. And that was it. Never looked back, you know.
So Dylan was the one?
Pretty much, yeah.
What other Dylan stuff kind of... is ingrained in you, apart from the Desire album?
I mean, you know, we went through the religious phase, didn't we? And that, just a great songwriter, you know. Brilliant.
The religious, I think the religious phase. Some of the songs are really, really good. Yeah,
he won a Grammy, didn't he?
Did he?
He's got to serve somebody.
Right, okay.
You know, but he's a great songwriter, you know. Amazing songwriter, you know. There's not many, it's weird doing music, but I can't stand going to gigs and I run a festival and I can't, you know, I just...
Have you seen him live?
Dylan, yeah. I have, yeah, a couple of times.
How did you find it? Because he obviously is well known that he
seen
changes.
Him in Birmingham, and it was rubbish, really. It was just, you know, it was all right.
Yeah.
Like, you know, but I was only young then, like 85 or something. But then I seen him a few years ago in Blackpool at the Opera House, I think it was, and it was amazing, absolutely. It was annoying because he weren't doing what I wanted him to do, you know, the tracks or the way, because he always changed them. But it was such a masterclass. It was amazing. He was 70 odd.
Yeah.
And I actually, you know, I got back to the hotel and had a great night, and I had a few beers, I was pretty pissed, and I rang Mark and left the right message on Mark's phone saying, you need to get your shit together, you know. I've just seen a 72-year-old there, you know, who's actually delivering, and you need to deliver and stuff. I remember waking up in the morning thinking, oh, shit, you know, what have I done? And then we laughed about it after, and he said, no, you were right, cock. He said, you were right, that, you know, you were right what you said, and, you know, I hope you like the new stuff and that, you know. I did take on board what you said, but I was actually drunk when I did it. To lie in your arms. You should not treat me like a
Here's a test for you. What was the name of the first song you ever wrote?
One that's never been released, and it's funny now looking back. So I wanted, you know, I didn't start till I was 27. First song I ever wrote. I started writing in Amsterdam when I turned things around. But there's a song, and I don't even know what it's called, Never Mind the Nonsense, I think it was called. And I didn't have a band, I wanted to do it, and, you know, got the confidence. And then this band said, right, do you want to come and have a go? So I went down on a Sunday afternoon, and they said, right, you know, what are the chords? And I was like, I haven't got a clue, you know what I mean? And said, well, I'll just sing it if you want. And we did it, and I thought it sounded really good. And they said, you know, I waited and waited, and then it was, oh, sorry, we've all had a chat, like, band meeting, and we just don't think it's right for us. And I was like,
oh,
you
know, man.
You fucking... And I wonder, within 6 months or something, I was playing the Hacienda with my band, and I thought, you know, and they were all, you know, they definitely didn't carry on the music. So I think that was probably the first song they ever wrote, yeah, and the most significant one.
And you just mentioned the Hacienda there. You told us before we started recording that you used to have some of the Hacienda dance floor, is that right?
Yeah. Well, I had, so Tony Wilson, two people gave me a break, really, could say, Marky Smith and Anthony H. Wilson. You know, our Trigger Happy was a band from South, we had a reputation, great band, no nonsense, you know. Good stuff.
You got playlisted on Radio 1, right? I think.
Yeah. You know, no money behind it. Just, you know, Salford band. All the usual stuff coming with it. And Wilson sent two of his younger managers, John Drape and Bobby Langley, to see us in London. And we played in the Orange Club in Kensington. I don't know if it still exists now. And great gig we did. And they're dangling bags of coke, saying, oh, stay down, and we were like, fuck off. We were back to Salford in the minibus.
Wow.
That was hired in someone else's name, because we had to get it back. You know, someone had stuck the neck on the line. And it was obviously the right move not to stay down and get off it. And then Wilson offered us a room in the Hacienda. He said, look, I've got no money to sign you. I think you're brilliant, what you're doing. And we'll give you a rehearsal room, you know, set of keys, effective to the Hacienda.
Yeah.
Bananas. They had some rooms upstairs called the Glass House. And he said, in a 500 quid account at Johnny Roadhouse, come get yourself a guitar and an amp. So I did. And, you know, we took him up on that. So we practically lived, and my marriage was over by then. And, you know, I was just like into doing my music and my band. So we'd come out of the Hacienda off it and then go straight to the rehearsal room, which was amazing, you know. And I wrote Rude All The Time, which is one of my most popular songs in there. And that was thanks to Wilson. And as I was in there, I remember the Hacienda was having difficult times. And I actually remember Wilson coming in with all the pieces of dance floor wrapped in like a yellow floor tape, wanting to sell them. And he was getting laughed at in the office. I think they were £1 each. This was like in the 90s, you know. And then some weirdly bizarre coincidence, you know, some, I don't know, 20 years later or something, I ended up buying these bundles of dance floor that I actually remembered seeing 20 years before for 50 quid. I mean, you couldn't write it, you know. And I'm very spiritual, me, and stuff, and I believe in things. And Wilson's always been around me. And in the same way Mark has, you know, Mark's seen me as that, and even though he's gone now, I still feel him, you know, and a lot's happened around the time of his death that's kind of benefited me in a way, or you know, a lot of good things have happened, and it's kind of what I've earned, I suppose, but yeah, I've rambled off a bit there, but yeah, you know, and Mark, like Wilson, the same, I think that was the same with the Fallen factory. Mark nearly signed for them, but you know, I think there was bigger money in London.
What ended up happening to the dance floor?
So I sold a lot of it, paid my bills, gave a lot away to charity. Actually burnt some. So there's a film about the Ascender.
That's right.
Ascender. I haven't seen it yet, but I believe I've been stitched up. You know, they've edited it. So I just say, yeah, I burnt the dance floor, but they didn't tell the story about, you know, the.
So what happened?
What, when I burnt it?
Yeah.
No, well, it was winter, and kind of like Enemy at the Gates, you know, times was hard, but we were having a laugh, and we'd had a few beers, and Matt was there, and, you know, it was a celebration as well to burn it. Just a piece at a time, didn't go over the top. And burnt a few pieces, you know, just like off it, keeping one, but enjoyed doing it, you know. Because it wasn't all about money, you know. But, oh, you could have got this and that, but it wasn't about the money. It was the joy of doing it, and you know.
A lot of memories tied up in all that, I'm guessing, as well. Tony Wilson, what would someone now in this generation learn from Tony Wilson, the way he did things? What's missing from this generation at Tony Wilson?
You know, like all your music colleges and everything else. Like, you know, it used to be really hard to go to uni and get on a music course. Now you can get them anywhere. So he would be dead against all that. It's kind of like the X Factor's crossed over into that. You know, he's like, you know, he should be written. He was a one-man band, and he just kept true to his loyals, and it wasn't all about the money. And if he believed in something, he backed it. And, you know, he took London on and won, in a way, you know. And he was behind, you know, when he opened the gates. And it wasn't just the Happy Mondays. All the groundwork had been done decades before. But what a guy, you know. And you'd see him at gigs. You know, if he come to your gig, he'd be there with a Mac on, a dodgy raincoat, like, you know, at the back of his collars up. And he'd keep a low profile, the ultimate A&R man. You know, and it's gone now, in a way. There's not many like that, is there, if any.
So what are your fondest memories that you've got with Tony?
Well, I don't know if they're the fondest, but so one year we applied to be on In the City, which was massive. And we got through as Trigger Happy. And then I got a phone call, and I was over the moon. You know, so hard to get a gig from Salford. And there was no favours, it was genuine. We got through, like, yes, buzzing. You know, we're going to Belfast. It was in Belfast. And then I got a phone call saying, you can't go because of your name. And I fucking absolutely hit the roof, you know.
Shit.
But funny enough, that was before I got the room. So I threatened him, like, you know, phoned up and snapped and said, if we don't go, you know, this and that. Stupidly, but just you know, I was like, what are you fucking on about? You know what I mean? You can't do that because of the name of the band. You know what I mean? We're not going to shoot anyone, Trigger Happy, because of the troubles in Northern Ireland. I can understand it. So probably that, you know, and then I heard in private that, you know, he absolutely admired me for it. And then we got on the year after as a consolation in Glasgow. But it was a bit shit because I was like, look, you know, I really respect you. I always have done. And you can't stop us playing. And he wanted us to, we did change the name when we were under the wing of the asset to Trigger X while we tried to find something, but we never found out, you know. and Trigger Upper was, you know, if you look in the dictionary, it's Trigger Upper and it's got Ed, and I actually just opened a page once and it was there, and you know, and it was to trigger an happiness. Trigger Upper, that's what the music was about, not to shoot someone, but because it was from Salford again, you know,
a negative
kind all of that thing, yeah.
Wow, so you really were up against it, you know,
in many ways.
Let's talk about the time when I think you were playing with Trigger Happy, and the rumour or legend goes that that the whole of the Fall kind of walked out on Marky Smith and he needed a band to step in, and you guys stepped in. Is that true? Is that what happened or not really?
Sort of. So he, I did a, we you know, Matt used to be at all our gigs, and he offered me the role as tour manager. So I said to him, I'll tell you what, I'll do it if Trigger Happy can support you on the main dates.
Nice move.
So he agreed, and we'd done a couple of them, and I had the Fall then staying at my house, the band, and they were all over the place. Great album, The Unutterable. But live and off stage, what a bunch of idiots, you know, couldn't put it any clearer than that, being polite, and they were just all over the place.
And
it was inevitable they were going to go, and the night before, I mean, a couple of them were digging in my house and all that, and I was like, listen, I'm not having that, you know what I mean? This has got, you know, Mark's like, don't beat them up and that. But I wanted to, and but Mark had his own reasons. They did sound good in rehearsals. We pulled up, Mark slated them all, and they said, look, we've had enough, and they got off that night. So they were ringing me, and I was trying to talk them down, saying, look, you know, we're going to Dublin in the morning, and they were like, fuck you, fuck Mark, you know, blah, 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 and it was like, right. So I listened to half an hour of that, and then I said, well, do you know what, then fuck off. They've already on the train back to London anyway. So I rang my band, and I said, look, we're still going, but we're not playing. You're in the Fall, you've got 8 hours to learn the set. And that's how it came about, as real as that.
And how do you, firstly, so how do you go about that? Because that can happen to musicians. So what is the process? Are you immediately saying to Mark, right, what is the set list? Here's the set list, and you're learning off the record? Or is he sitting there talking through the songs? How did you actually...
Well, we was great with Crisis, is me and Mark. You know, we was just great together. You know, that's when me and him came to our best. You know, and he just said, right, you know, you let's do this song. You sort it out, basically. So I was like, oh, cheers, Matt. Mm-hmm. And so we did, just said, look, learn these songs. And it was bizarre. It was Dublin, you know, and it was very bizarre. And he's like, don't let anyone backstage and that, you know, keep it all under wraps. But we did pull it off. And the crowd, the claps was like, you know, because Mark could fall over and he'd say it was genius.
Mm.
But we pulled it out of the bag, you know, we pulled it out of the bag that night. We just managed to do it.
Wow, that's a lot of pressure. But it's great that you kind of thrive in that time of crisis. That's really interesting. And when going forward, and when you played further gigs with him, how did the band select the set list, given there was such a body of work, like there's hundreds of songs they could have picked from? So how did that go about? Did you have to learn all of them, or before?
No, it was always about the new stuff, and the greatest hits and that gigs weren't allowed. You know, it was, you know, the band had said, oh, Mark, can we do this one? You know, and he'd say, all right, then chuck that one in. But there was only ever one or two, you know.
So it was always touring what was the newest thing out?
Yeah.
Right, okay, I got you. And Stuart Lee said that he would go to see, like, say, four nights in a row, and two songs could be completely different. Like, one song could be 4 minutes or 20 minutes. Were you just given kind of leeway to do whatever you wanted, or did...
Well, I was, you know what I mean? I don't ever admit to being in the Fall, do you know what I mean? Which yeah. I wasn't a member of the Fall. I was, you know... I want in the band, you know, I just came on whenever I wanted and did whatever I wanted, and Marty say, look, you got carte blanche, you know what I mean, do whatever you want, so I did.
Wow.
You know, and if I couldn't be asked going on, I won't, you know, I was doing a lot behind the scenes. But no, they were always, you know, the band would try and have you think that they was, you know, when Mark was just a drunk, was it Mark controlled everything, you know, and I helped him.
And, I mean... With the kind of relationships that Mark had with some of the people in the band, how would you advise a manager about managing a band like the Fall? You've been through it all, man. Like, how the fuck?
Jump at it, you know what I mean? Jump at it. Jump in with 2 feet, you know, that's what I did. And I had, like, 2-3 days' notice to find him a band. Originally to find him a drummer, you know. When I did this deal about the supports, he said, right, yeah, give you 100 quid a day, Cat. He said, oh, by the way, I'm playing in London on Monday. I need a drummer. You know, and I was like, right. I said, and he said, then the tour starts Wednesday. This was on a Friday. And I said, well, I'll tell you what, I'll sort it by Wednesday, which I did. You know, but it was great, you know, and I had to borrow a couple of grand off my sister to pay for the tour bus and stuff like that. And it was a great experience, you know. You know.
What about managing the personal relationships between members of the band? Because, I mean, he famously had quite, like, a bit of an acid tongue. And, you know, I think he... there's like I've seen a few places that like he had these hilarious put downs, and one of them was like, I can't work with him anymore because like he was eating a salad and stuff like that. Is the reason why Mark sacked someone because he was eating a salad? That was the last straw. How did you deal with that as a manager? Like, he was famous for that.
Well, I one of me, you know, I lost my virginity, if you like, and the thing was the first night in Dublin, and some guy come backstage. And Matt was saying, you know, keep everything sweet, don't let anyone know what's going on with the new band and stuff. And this guy's there from the Virgin Prunes. And he's like, hey, Mark, how are you? And all that, Harold, Mark. And Mark's like, shut up, you daft cunt, have a beer. And he said, oh, Bono sends his regards. And sorry you couldn't make it tonight, but you're invited to the castle. After he said, listen, tell Bono to go fuck himself. And I stood there and thought, I like you too, you know what I mean? And I thought, right, okay, then this is how it rolls, is it? But he was dead genuine.
Yeah.
You know, and he was right. He couldn't be arsed with all the rubbish. And when band members got told how it was, you know, they deserved it, you know. Like, we weren't an E-taking band, so some of the band were taking E's. It's like, well, you know what? And when they got up in the morning, their heads were like, you know, all over the place. It's not what you need at all. You're allowed a drink and that a lot, you know. But we worked really hard, me and him, you know. While they were all thinking they were in Oasis, that's what he used to say, you know, you're not fucking in Oasis. But we used to pay him more than what you get in Oasis.
And what do people not understand about Mark? So if you meet the odd person who was a fan of Mark E. Smith, you, having been such a close friend to him, what do people not understand about him?
I don't think they understood the how genuinely nice he was underneath. And I understand why he was so pissed off when he was. And, you know, if you've been in the business that long and you've met that many people who are fake and that, and he's seen it all, and he's seen members trying to overthrow him and form their own groups and stuff. I think you just build a certain skin, and that's why he was so thick-skinned and so, you know, sharp-tongued with people, because he's seen it all and done it all. But beneath that, you know, he was a really nice guy who just, like, wanted a pint and sit down, talk about football, you know. Just a normal working bloke.
What made him happy?
I did. You know, you know, we used to have some great times together. Just getting away from the band, really. You know, when we break away from the band, that was when he was at his happiest. He never did that, you know, he couldn't stand, really. He'd do the bit where he had to have a drink in the bar with the band for a little bit, just for prep talk. And then, you know, soon he's like, oh, thank God for that, you know. Like, he wanted to do, when we were doing the spoken word stuff, he's like, this is the way forward. And the Smith and Blaney stuff before they broke, is it? We were getting off of more money than the Fall getting off. He said, this is great, Cock. It's just me, you and a Tasha case, you know. Way forward. I think just like, you know, our nights out, we used to have some great nights out, you know, and they weren't like nothing to do with music.
So that's really interesting. So he was quite happy, because it strikes me from a distance, and not obviously nowhere near meeting him ever, but he seemed quite an unhappy person. Would you say that would be... inaccurate then in that case, you think he was quite...
I think if he'd have been anything other than the person he was, his career would have died 20, 30 years ago. I think that's what kept people interested, but it wasn't an act.
Yeah.
It was a weird one, but he was always working, always working away on something, you know. But when it was time to stop work, then he'd say, look, that's it, you know, let's have a pint.
When you were someone like Mark, who's written so many songs and come up with so many lines, what was the creative kind of well he'd go to when he had a blank piece of paper in front of him? Like, when you've written so many songs and been doing it for so many years, when you were with him, like, where do you even begin? Where was he finding his, in inverted commas, inspiration lyrically, for instance, in that situation?
Well, you know, he'd just write his stuff, wouldn't he? He'd just write his stuff, but he was a big fan of my lyrics. So, I wrote lyrics on I Wake Up in the City. Mm-hmm. And it's funny when that come out, you know, it's like really rated and puts all the best rhyming couplets he's done in 22 years.
And it's you.
You know, and he asked me to ghostwrite, which I refused to do, you know. But he respected me for that, you know.
Yeah.
And I used to challenge him lyrically and push him, you know, and say, you're not having it that easy, you know. And he'd do it, you know. I mean, some of the stuff he wrote, amazing.
Yeah.
Very prophetic as well.
Yes. Can you give examples?
Well, The Towers, when we did Are You Our Missing Winner, you know, World War III, skyscrapers, and that was literally 2 months. I think we released it it wasn't far off. Well, it was certainly recorded before The Towers fell, but Crop Dust, yeah, some lyrics in there, and it's like, wow. And we was in America at the time, 10 weeks after we toured America with that album, and that was a bit bizarre.
How did the stuff go down?
Great. Yeah. Sold out every night. Amazing. Absolutely amazing. 4, 5, 6 encores every night. All of them times. You know, people talk about the fall in the 80s. Great. You know, that lineup would not have made it in my band.
Mm.
Not a chance. It was sloppy. You know, Mark was always, you know, they weren't, it was, it, you know, the...
Was he hiring the wrong people? Like, why? Because it's quite a constant, isn't it, that the band was sloppy?
With
a
lot of them, they just get sloppy and then they get jealous of the lead singer. Because it's all about the lead singer, and everyone wanted to interview Mark and talk about Mark, and Mark was the persona, Mark was the fall, you know. And it's like, even when they left, 20 odd years, I mean, you're not in the band anymore, you know. They're still on Jules Holland, they're on Glastonbury, and they're not playing the songs that they played when you were in the band. Get over it, you know. A lot of many members, you know. And I think everyone put a shift in, but when your time was up, just accept it. And they're still trying to hang on to it now. You know, I'm talking, I was never in the fall, you know what I mean? Mm. I did what I did and I enjoyed it.
You had a great gig. Sounds like you had a great gig, kind of not being a full-time member of the fall, but being able to come in and do what you wanted live and that kind of thing and manage,
you know, it. It was great. And then, you know, the band was like always a challenge, but we always looked after the band, you know.
Mm.
They might say different, like in the book The Fallen, I mean, some of the stories in there, and credit to Dave Simpson, he told me that he edited it, thank God. You know, and I think people just imagine things and stuff and say things, you know. My memory's pretty good. We looked after them, the band, you know. And they're very lucky. I mean, where else would you get 100 quid a day?
Mm.
All your food, drink and everything else, and the hotel, and driven everywhere, and burgers delivered to your room. Not many bands would, you know, do that.
Yeah.
Well, I wake up in the city, I look around to see who's with me. All the thoughts that pull of me, canal and a gallery.
You were saying that you kind of negotiate with Glastonbury like a really decent rate when you played there like a few years ago. It's such an eye-opener with the industry. In regards to, let's talk about live. So obviously you played sometimes with The Fall, but obviously you were on the side a lot of it as well. Think about the time you saw the band most laughing on stage. What had happened? When was the when you saw the band kind of most enjoying themselves on a stage?
Which band?
The Fall.
Probably the penultimate gig, is that whatever that means. The best gig was San Francisco, live in San Francisco. And it's actually released that recording. And so I'm saying, and it was the only night I didn't have to go on. And the girl who was looking after the venue and the booking, she it was the first proper, she said, do you want a drink? And I said, yeah, I'll have a brandy and coke.
Mm.
And it was the first proper brandy and coke I'd had in America, where it was in a tall glass, you know. And I was like, Remy Martin, it was like brilliant. And all I had to do was stand there. The band went on, it was like a 70-minute long train, non-stop, and it was incredible. And there was like 800 people, Great American Music Hall, it sold out. And, you know, that was a moment where I'd delivered. And I think it was only a few gigs, a few nights into the tour, but we'd done all the UK, we'd done all Europe, and that was, you know, Mark was buzzing for Ed, you know, and take us back to America. And I did it, and that was probably the best gig ever for me, to be stood at the side of that stage and just enjoyed myself and didn't have to go on, didn't have to change anything, didn't have to rescue anything, you know, it was just an amazing night.
Compare that to, what was it like in Moscow then? Because you toured in Moscow as well, I think, is that right? What was that like, and how did that differ to your expectations?
Complete opposite. Well, I'd been through a car windscreen 3 days before. I was still suffering from concussion.
Shit.
Half my face was black and blue, and I had a limp. But I looked the part in the suit, with a black eye, smoking on stage as I was playing. Remember that? Mark was late one night, and the promoters weren't happy. And it was very much a mafia thing, you know.
Not really?
Gonna lie. Well, I didn't know that till I got there, but it wasn't. I was on a deal where, you know, I brought the fall over and I could have what I wanted. And I said, "Well, I have champagne." He said, "We can have unlimited champagne." You know, so I was like, "Right, I'll have that then." But the first night, Mark was late and from the hotel, and they wasn't happy, and they had to give refunds out and stuff.
Really?
And he wasn't happy at all, and they said, "Look, you're all right, but him. You tell him, you know, if he doesn't fucking, you know, if he's late again tomorrow, he'd be going missing. We'll drop him off in the middle of fucking nowhere. This is Russia." I was like, "Okay, no problem." You know what I mean? And they said, "And your champagne's finished." And I said, "Is it? Yeah, we'll see about that." And I absolutely hammered it more the next night. And you know, you're in a restaurant and they give you the leather booklets with your receipt, and I had them here, there, everywhere, about 25.
Yeah, well.
But I think it was just nerves with Mark.
Really?
Yeah, it was nerves, you know, Russia and that. You know, it was big. He'd never played Russia before. But people had travelled like hundreds and hundreds of miles, you know, to see him.
So what was the crowd like?
It was amazing. It was great. Yeah, it was on fire.
Did you play St. Petersburg as well?
No,
it?
Just Moscow.
Just
two
Moscow.
Nights, yeah,
two nights in Moscow.
Yeah.
Fucking hell, sounds amazing. Drink the line, drink the line, drink, drink the line, drink. Okay, so let's talk about the festival that you were running for a few years.
Yeah.
Is in Salford, right?
Yeah.
Now, you gave opportunity to 1,200 bands, I think, over those years. But you always kind of said along that time that it was a bit of a stress and it was a challenge all the way through doing that. I once put on one festival in Dagenham and I retired the day after I did it because it was so stressful. What advice would you give to festival organisers given your experience?
Again, just do it. You know, I mean, I look back now and it's well over 1,400 bands, and I see some of the lineups and I think, fucking hell, how did I do that? You know what I mean? I can't even remember. Like, biggest year, 342 bands, 22 venues running consecutively. I have no idea how I did it. There was no money, no funding, but I did it. And it's like, wow, you know, and I did it last year. I've had 1 year off since 2010. I did it again last year, and it was the smallest number of bands, smallest number of venues, and the stress was just the same.
Really?
So
why?
I learned that. I don't know, but that's one thing I learned from last year, that the amount of stress level was just exactly the same as having like hundreds of bands on.
So what's the lesson there? What would you advise
just
someone?
Carry on.
Yeah,
carry on and do it. You know, at least you've done it. And it doesn't matter, you know, I mean, if you do it for free, And it's a success and that, you know. Great. You know, everyone's had a good time. And, you know, we had, like, Catfish in the Bottlemen on before anyone had heard of them, and loads of other artists, you know. And some come back and say cheers, you know. Thanks, you know, you give us a slot when no one else would even give us a slot. So it is that.
Because you once said that you to get on festivals, like the really big festivals across the UK, you need to have an agent or know someone. And you kind of went the other way and gave opportunities to bands that, you know, other places weren't taking on. Can you kind of unpack that for us, if you're a young band now, how you get on festival bills and what the barriers are?
Yeah, don't fill in them forms online where you have to sign up to something, and that's a complete waste of your time, and you know, upload this and all that rubbish, you know. I won't name them, but you'll know who you are. Stop it. I mean, just kidding people, you know, sign up for this, and then, you know, nobody even listens to your demo for a start, you know. The only way to get on a festival is, you know, if you're a new young band, is just do whatever you think you have to do and use every blag and trick in the book, because that's the only thing that's going to work. No one's going to do you any favours. It's going to be you with your skills, or one of the cheeky one in the band, let him deal with it or her deal with it. You know, and just do the old-fashioned way, send out CDs. Oh, we don't do CDs, just ignore that. Send out a CD, you know, because it's something, when a CD arrives at your house or whatever, you know, it's got more chance of being listened to than doing it in the mail order way, where, you know, it's a very difficult thing, because it is even more so now, because most of the festivals have been bought up by the same company. So there's one booker that's booking nationally. And
really?
Oh, yeah. So it's the same lineup pretty much on every festival, all the big ones. Apart from Glastonbury, you'll find, you know, it's like, right, you know, they don't have any say, most bands, do they? And it's like, here's the festivals you're doing this year. There's 11 of them and you're playing 8 with that band again. And you're not, you know, there's no money in it, you know, but at least you're on, you know, get on the bus and stop moaning. That's how it is. So if you're in a young band and you can get on a festival, just get on. I mean, I'm not into these competitions. I think it's demeaning. You know, people need to have a word with themselves. It's, you know, it is the X Factor. It's crossed over into normal rock and roll, which is a disgrace in my, you know. And I feel sorry for them. I'm like, what do you mean, vote for you? Vote for you to be on at 1:30 in the afternoon when the gates opened at past 4:15 and they're still hoovering up, you know. And they're pushing it, aren't they? Oh, vote for us so we can get on. And I was like, yeah, but there's nobody who gives a shit. You know, yeah. You're not even going to be on the poster.
Yeah. You've opened a bar, is that right?
Yeah.
Tell us about your bar.
Yeah, it's a fantastic space. Just came about, and I've been after the venue for a bit. It's a 3-minute walk from Piccadilly train station. Yeah, bar, that's YE and 4 R's. Yeah, great, you know. So
what's the aim of the bar?
It's just, again, it's just one of them, just going with it and letting it evolve itself. So we opened with a student exhibition, an art exhibition, which was really good. We've had a few bookings in from that, and the live music first night is a week on Saturday, yeah, which my band will be playing as well.
Cool. Under the name Blaney?
Yeah.
Nice.
So that's going to be good.
Are you playing any of the new stuff, or...?
I think so, yeah. I think we're going to start. So obviously having your own bar venue, I mean, it's great. So we're going to set up all the gear on Monday, and we'll be rehearsing in there next week, which is great, you know. So we'll just see how it goes. That probably do about 8 songs or something.
Yeah, nice. With
cracking lineup. And again, it goes back to opening doors for new acts. So my daughter's playing, who's doing well at the moment off her own back, and then there's another band, the C33s, there's a young band from London, Moses, who are playing. They've had a bit of, so I'm doing it all right again, get opening doors for new acts and stuff, and it's free entry.
Awesome.
So that's going to be good.
Cool. Well, it's certainly going to pop down there when next in the area. Is it right you've got 5 kids?
Yeah.
How does having 5 kids change you as an artist compared to someone if they didn't have any kids?
Well, Dylan's got 5, hasn't he?
But really?
I think, yeah. But yeah, I had mine when I was young, so by the time I was 23, 24, I had 5 kids, which is unbelievable now. You know, my youngest is 25, and none of my kids, you know, I'll be a granddad this year, which I'm looking forward to. Brilliant. I wouldn't change it for anything. I can't remember much of it, you know.
Does it change you when you're writing, thinking my kids will hear this? Do you change?
I used to, my kids used to, you know, ask me to play to send them to sleep. You take that 2 ways, really. Yeah. Wouldn't you? But in a nice way, I think, you know, which has stayed with me. And yeah, Bianca, who's doing chosen music, she's doing really well. So that's nice. And yeah, I mean, I just think, well, what would I be like if I was them and my dad was, you know, I'm 50 now, and I'm not no sign of me slowing down, you know. And I'm not pissing in the wind or kidding myself, you know. I have a good time and I've done all right out of music myself, doing what I do, and I'm enjoying it. It's like this Berlin, this new album, I think will be my best, without a doubt. Not that there's out wrong with, and that's me, I'm telling myself there, because I can hear my daughter and my head, she always says, don't, you know, my kids love me doing what I do with my music, you know. And it, I don't know, it inspires you in a way, you know, to think that obviously there'll be a day when I'm not here, and that's going to be a shit day, isn't it, for my kids and everyone else. But, you know, you think, well, I'm more conscious now about what I write. So there are things in The Severance, you know, which is a symbolic album of cutting away from stuff which I have done, all the Deadwood, I've left that behind. And so this new album is free. Mm. And you know, first things on it, people are loving it, you know, and saying it's the best thing I've ever done, and that's really good. So we just carry on with that. And I just feel glad, really, that I've had five kids, and, you know, I can't change anything. You know, years ago, I would have loved a normal job, but I've never, you know, I've always done my own thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's not for really lack of trying, it's just how it is, you know.
But most people who have a normal job would probably prefer to have your lifestyle.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
Like the experiences maybe. You've had, you know what I mean? You know. So, what was the biggest setback in your career, and how did you overcome it?
Being from Salford, probably.
Really?
Yeah, and it still goes on now. We're still discriminated against. You know, there ought to be a movement against that.
Yeah.
Because it is true. You know,
I had no idea. Wow.
You know, if you've got an opinion, or you've got something to say, or you're actually a bit clued up, then that goes against you. Because you don't want that, you know. People just want you to shut up, get had over, and then do get the next one in. You know, and if you've got something to say. So I think probably coming from Salford, you know.
What's the most important piece of kind of music memorabilia you have? So something from your career that you really, really cherish, that if the house is burning down, your family are safe. What's the thing that's most important to you that's related to music that you have?
Probably nothing, if I'm being honest. Yeah, I mean, I've got a few bits. I'm not that... I just think you can't take it with you, you know. I mean, you know, you're as good as your last gig, and whatever you've got, you know, and whatever time you've got, enjoy that and clear out the decks.
What's the best bit of advice someone's given you?
Jesus, I've had quite a bit over the years. Probably Mark, in a way, you know, that would be a nice one. So on the album, the Smith and Blaney album, there's a track, When We Were Young. And at the end, I've cut Mark's voice in, and he just says, just carry on, keep doing what you're doing. And yeah, so before he died, Mark, last meeting we had, you know, he said, listen, you know, you're top mate and everything, and you are a true friend. And toughen up, you know, keep doing what you're doing and don't let anyone, you know, take the piss and that. So probably Mark, yeah.
How did he view mortality and how did he view his illness and
how things before went? He told me he was going to die, I knew what he was going to say. And we had this, you know, about psychic stuff going on, but we're both a bit out there like that and believing stuff. And I knew before he opened his mouth what was going to come out of it. And he was scared, I think. Yeah, he was scared, you know, genuinely scared about it. But I didn't see him months before. He didn't want to see anyone. He didn't want anyone to see him in the state he was in. But I know he was happy. His sister, you know, he'd seen stuff about me in the paper with my new album. And he'd heard The Severance and he loved it. He absolutely loved the tracks he heard, you know. Feel the Rain, he said, that's a fucking hit, you know, he said, just edit that, this and that. So he did have a hand in a bit of the production on it, but yeah, I think he was scared, which he would be, you know. You know, because he was almost like a cockroach, Mark, you know, you never thought he'd go.
Yeah, he survived a lot beforehand.
He did, you know, when I first took over, I used to think I'd find him dead pretty much every day in the hotel, you know.
Really?
Some mornings, yeah, I'd think, Jesus, is he going to be alive? Yeah. And he outlived most of his critics, didn't he?
Yeah.
Which was great. And we laughed about that. We had some laughs on that before he died. Wasn't all sad.
And how did you find out? On the news or did you?
My guitarist. I knew it was coming.
Yeah.
I pulled my social media a couple of days before. You know, I knew it was coming.
Really?
And stuff. So I knew, like, Jesus, long time before. I had to manage that. So obviously I talked to a few people in the press that I knew who was sniffing, and I said, look, this is what's going on. I didn't tell them the full story, and I said, look, work with us. And, you know, credit to the press, they did. They kept a lid on it, yeah.
Good.
Which is nice.
And how are you, like, how are you processing that stuff? That's some heavy stuff to have to process over the last year and stuff.
Yeah, I mean, Jesus, it knocked me for six, you know. Even if you know it's coming when it actually comes, and he was like one of my best mates, you know what I mean? And we used to have some top times together, and it wasn't always work stuff. And then, so I've never lost a mate before, you know what I mean? So, I have moments, I'm all right now, and, you know, he'd say, don't be a soft cunt, that's what he'd say, you know, what's the matter with you? You know, but, it was difficult for a while, you know. Well, I think I just cut myself off, and then when I made that film,
yeah, tribute, beautiful,
you know,
tribute
that helped
film.
Me a lot.
Yeah,
that really, because that's what I wanted to do, and I got to do it, so that got a lot of things out there.
So strongly recommend listeners to check that out. So it's on the website. So yeah, is that right?
ye4rs.co.uk,
and it's through YouTube as well. It's a brilliant tribute that Ed's done to Mark. That's really, really beautiful. What are some of your proudest moments in your career?
Now, doing what I'm doing now, standing up, doing this new album, you know, I'm signed to BMG on the publishing. They need to pull the finger out if they want to keep me for the next album, that's for sure. Get collecting them royalties. And just carry on inspiring people and being there for my family and my friends and my kids, really.
So what are the classic stories you tell your grandchildren when they're old enough? So you're just becoming a grandfather soon, so what are the classic stories you're going to tell them when they're old enough?
Well, you know, there's that many. You know, there's that many.
Come on.
Just be yourself and be, you know, I don't know. Have you got an hour? You know, there's so many great stories, but the positive ones are always the best.
What's your favourite one? Come
on. I probably couldn't pick one, you know. Just to keep fighting, you know, in a generalised thing, is just, you know, keep going. You know, don't listen to people putting shit in your head, you know, and defy the odds.
I definitely sense that from the talk today, that it's like, don't look too much in the past. Like,
yeah, definitely don't look back, you know. Keep going forward, because you never know, you know what I mean? You never know, game could be over in an hour, in a day, a week. So just live, and I'm always evolving, and I'm probably at my best now than I've ever been.
What fears do you have about the music industry going forward? And how would you address those fears?
I think it's completely fucked. Anyway, as it is, so I don't think the fears could get any worse. You've got artists disillusioned, thinking they're going to make it. There's nothing to make it for when you get there. You know, there's nothing on the top of the hill. You know, penny a stream, penny a play. It's a difficult one. So, you know, for me, it's just about enjoying it. You know, if you can enjoy it, and you can cover a few of your expenses, then just do that, because it's not what it was. And I don't want to sound old or miserable, but it's just not the same. And even though a picture will be painted, it looks all beautiful, and, you know, underneath that, the artist will be running up thousands and thousands of pounds and living out of the means. And then that's when the boulder arrives at the end of the 2 years or whatever, and they realise they've just wasted 2 years of life. So just keep control of it yourself. And for me, for fears, my fear is a reality I see every day, you know, and I feel sorry for people who are disillusioned by it. You know, and they're sold marketing packages, like courses, you know. I'm totally against them, because I think, why don't you just be honest? And tell them how hard it is to actually earn money. You know, if you're in a covers band, you'll get paid. You know, if you're doing stuff like that, you know, or corporate stuff, you know, But doing original music these days, you know, it's so hard, and I don't even think the publishers can do anything about it, you know, because they're forever being undercut. So it's kind of at itself. It's, I've got nothing good to say about it. Hope for them.
And that's because of the streaming, right?
Yeah, streaming has absolutely killed music, you know, and people, you know, only the diehard hardcore fans appreciate a CD and a vinyl, you know. Vinyl's had a boost, this and that, but half of it's bullshit.
Yeah.
You know, it's not sold that many, you know what I mean? It's making a comeback and all that. It's just a great market ploy. It's worked for some, but for others, it hasn't.
And generally, the people who are buying the vinyls are the age group that would have bought in the first place anyway. Do you know what I mean? So it's not like engaging like 16 or 17 year olds.
They just lost it. But, you know, I don't want to sound like too negative. If you do music and you're in it, you know, go for it. And because, you know, it literally, I was trying to put a number on it last night, and it's like 0.1% that actually make it. And then you got to ask yourself, what is making it? And then at what price does that come to you as an individual? So just enjoy it, you know, just enjoy it and stuff. Do it for you, not for anyone else.
Great advice. Any ambitions left? What are the
I want this album to absolutely go worldwide and get, you know, I think the last two albums, the reviews have been great, and, you know, just because we've not had 15, 20 grand to put into the, is out on my label, but I want this one to really travel and end up, you know.
Well, it sounds like it's going well. Thanks for coming down. Thanks for sharing your insight, your stories and experience. You've lived the dream of many, actually, and we wish you well with the new venue. Can't wait to hear the third album when it's good to go. And I'm guessing that will be available to check out on blaney.co, is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah, nice one. And yeah, is the name of the bar, so we'll check that out near Manchester Piccadilly. Hope you enjoyed it, and thanks for being such a great guest on the Stage Left Podcast.
Very welcome. Thanks for having us. All the best. Nice
Cheers.
One.
Nice one. So that was Ed Blaney. What a top man, hey. Such a likeable character. And we really, really enjoyed having him on the podcast. There's so much crossover in what he's trying to achieve, and I think what we want to do going forward as well. So we did have some kind of chats afterwards about how we can work together in future again. So watch this space for that. Remember, for more episodes featuring likes of Stuart Lee, the comedian, recorded just 2 days before actually Mark E. Smith passed away, talking about how much The Fall meant to him. Go to thestageleftpodcast.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at @thestageleftpod, like us on Facebook at facebook.com/thestageleftpodcast. And there's loads of episodes with the likes of Tony Visconti on recording Black Star, Steve Cropper on writing Sitting on the Dock of the Bay with Otis Redding. That's a howitzer of an episode. And Aziz Ibrahim on playing in the Stone Roses too. So plenty there to get your teeth stuck into. We'll see you next time for Jess Greenfield of Noel Gallagher's High Flying Birds.